This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM.
I am Amy Sings in the Timber, the executive director of the Montana Innocence Project.
And on today's show of What Do You Know, Scott and I are going to delve into the Montana Innocence Project and how Amy Sings in the Timber got to be the executive director, her meandering, circuitous route to that.
When we come back, we will be joined by Amy Sings in the Timber, executive director of the Montana Innocence Project. Back after these words.
Amy, welcome to the show. It's great to see you again.
It's great to see you.
So for our listeners, give us the quick thumbnail, and we'll do a deep dive as we go along. But the quick thumbnail of what the Montana Innocence Project is all about.
Right. So the Montana Innocence Project is really a law firm in a lot of respects. We work on exclusively post-conviction relief in cases where there are claims of actual innocence, as well as in cases where there are instances of what we call manifest injustice, or there's some kind of deep mitigation that took place either prior to trial or at the trial level that would compromise justice in anybody's given case.
So you've shared with me previously a case of manifest injustice related to an 18-year-old Native American girl. Could you share the general dynamics of that case? Because this really vividly brings to life why there is a need for an innocence project.
Certainly. So to give an example of what a manifest injustice is there's some sort of disproportionate punishment, or there could be a real case for somebody who's had a lot of underlying trauma themselves. They've experienced some pretty significant trauma prior to a crime being committed that wasn't considered at the trial level. So this particular instance, it is a young Native woman, 18 at the time of conviction, and a gun was fired in the crime, but nobody was actually injured in this instance. And this young woman subsequently was sentenced to 90 years. At the age of 18, that's an effective life sentence.
She didn't hit anybody. This was somebody who had...
But she unloaded discharged a weapon.
Discharged a firearm.
Right.
And it was somebody who she has had conflict with in the past.
And it was a family member who had been, for years, this young woman's abuser. The young woman was trying to leave and take a vehicle, and family member was trying to stop her from leaving, and a gun was brandished and then discharged. But at the age of 18, I would like to think that a reasonable mind would consider all of the circumstances and say that a 90-year sentence is pretty excessive.
Right. Sure. So a Montana judge has made that sentence. It has gone through some kind of preliminary review, I guess, yes. And it's been upheld.
So this particular individual tried going through a sentence review process, was denied, and then also filed an appeal. In order to be eligible for Montana Innocence Project legal services, you have to have exhausted all of your appeals.
It's amazing that it even got to you.
Well, we found it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So there's, a number of different ways that cases come to light.
And that makes it even worse.
Most often, we receive handwritten letters from folks who are incarcerated in Montana and sometimes out of the state of Montana. So I mentioned a moment ago that our eligibility is you have to have exhausted all of your appeals.
Right.
It means you can't have a public defender available to you or an appellate defender available to you.
Sure.
In order to qualify for our services. We really are kind of your last hope. We're your last resort in many ways, unless you can afford to hire a criminal defense attorney to represent you in your post-conviction relief proceedings, or you go it alone. So most often we get these handwritten letters from individuals who are incarcerated in the state of Montana. But sometimes we learn about somebody's case from a lot of times a family member or a loved one. And sometimes we learn about them from other practitioners in Montana or other allied agencies, mm-hmm. you know, individuals who are providing prison ministry or reentry services. And folks go into the prison facilities and hear about something that seems unjust, right? And then they kind of are moved for one reason or another to say, who out there can help with this case?
Is it fair to say that Montana has a disproportionate number of women in prison compared to other states, and then additionally a disproportionate number of the women incarcerated here are Native American?
As a matter of fact, the Prison Policy Institute just released a report a couple of weeks ago that ranked states as though they were individual countries. So they took a look at incarceration of women specifically in the world right now. And for the last 50 years, the incarceration rates overall have been ballooning. The U.S. is the largest incarcerator of anyone in the world. But when they took the state breakdown,
yes.
And they ranked it, the largest incarcerators in the world of women, it's number one, South Dakota, number two, Montana, and number three, El Salvador. So per capita, we are the second largest incarcerator of women in the world. And right now, the Montana women's prison population are pushing 50% Native American. So when you think about the
With the female Native population of Montana is what, 7%, 6%?
Just under 7%.
So it's not seven times the percentage. Why is that?
Oh, that's a very complex and complicated question. But there are a number of things at play. One is federal policy that has been in the works for 100 years or more that lead to a number of different conditions. The other is, you know, we've got state policies that cause a lot of pressures in different ways. There are socioeconomic status factors mm-hmm. that are absolutely at play, but those socioeconomic status factors are there and they're, you know, in place because of colonialism, genocide, and federal Indian policy that has upheld these types of systematic oppression.
Sure. But let's be clear for our listeners, you're not just working with Native American women, and any person who is, you know, manifestly charged unfairly or has a case where they've been convicted wrongly convicted, you would take if they've exhausted all their other remedies.
That's right. We provide legal services to anybody who has been convicted of a crime in the state of Montana that meets our eligibility criteria.
And about how many cases is that a year?
So we review on average about 150 applications a year for legal services.
Oh my God.
And
how many cases do you take?
That it varies from year to year based on the types of cases that we receive. So,
and your budget and how many people you can put to work on this.
That's absolutely right. We do. We have a small but mighty team. And
so how many are you?
We just hired on an advancement director, putting us at seven.
Seven, got it.
Yeah, seven, but really, truly, two staff attorneys working on cases actively. We have three attorneys on staff, if you include me in the mix, and I can step up in a pinch, but really, truly, two attorneys.
Can you share with us your operating budget?
Yes. Right now, in 2025, our operating budget is just over $850,000.
But you're facing challenges because a portion of that budget is federal money that's being curtailed.
That's correct. We were the recipients of a grant that was very focused on the innocence work that we do through the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Administration. And the particular source of funding was called Preventing Wrongful Convictions and Upholding the Rule of Law. And we were in the competitive grant process for that funding, received that funding, and we now are in a place where that solicitation has been pulled down and has not been put back up again. We're uncertain as to
what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Does every state have an innocence project?
Every state does not have an innocence project. There are so the Innocence Network is a voluntary membership organization or entity of the Innocence Project. We're not a parent affiliate kind of scenario, like you might think of the ACLU, for example, being. Rather, you know, the original Innocence Project was a clinical legal program at Cardozo Law School and has since become a not-for-profit organization in and of itself. But there are Innocence Projects that operate all throughout the U.S. and a few internationally as well. And as long as you meet a certain set of criteria, you're eligible to apply for membership within this network. There's 74 Innocence organizations currently, and we're kind of a wide mix of types of organizations. Some are not-for-profits. Some are actual clinical programs of law schools, so they're part of a university system. We are not. Others are part of government entities like Office of Public Defenders or even prosecutors' offices, conviction integrity units in some instances. And so we really operate in some very different ways. The sort of core set of principles that we adhere to is that we represent individuals in their cases and their claims.
And you take private funding too, right? And
we are, you know, for a long time, we were exclusively
funded.
Privately funded. I came on in January of 2020 and worked really, we were like working overtime to diversify our funding. Because that's, you know, when you think of the principles of not-for-profits, you think of funds diversification equals health, right? Like fiscal health. And the reality is we were successful in diversifying funds. And then right at a time when there's a lot of shifts, in philanthropic priorities and a lot of shifts in corporate priorities. And of course, federal funding scenes are always fickle, right? They're always fickle, no matter what. You're facing an administrative change on federal funding can change a whole lot in a short amount of time.
So, Amy, you're like a lot of successful leaders that we talk to, particularly in the not-for-profit sector, who started out, you went to law school, you were a lawyer. You didn't go to law school to be a not-for-profit agency administrator and raise money. That wasn't your primary goal.
I didn't think so at the time.
No. But that's what you're doing now. But walk us back a little bit. Tell us about your background growing up, how you ended up going to law school in University of Montana, and how you got into this niche compared to all the other, you know, things you could have been doing as an attorney.
Sure. So I have a pretty nonlinear way of thinking and a pretty nonlinear
background. Well, by the way, go back. Where were you born?
I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay. Start there.
Okay. yes. So born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and lived in Wisconsin until the mid-90s. And my family is very much a blue-collar union worker family. I grew up, you know, with union organizers and really watching how those dynamics played out in.
Did you grow up with any tribal involvement also at that time?
No, really. So I was not raised on a reservation. I was not really raised in a way that puts tribal cultural practices at the forefront of my upbringing. So I grew up in you know, this very blue-collar setting, and I really was an artist as a kid. I ended up applying to art schools in high school and received a scholarship to go to a couple of art schools, ended up settling on the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design,
mm-hmm.
At my dad's suggestion, because it was the smart fiscal thing to do, is to stay at home and go to art school on scholarship. So while I was at MIAD, I kind of was stuck in a hard place, thinking that I was pretty unhappy at that school, and most of my art up to that point had been activist art and of fine art nature.
Right.
So I dropped out of art school, and I was working full-time, a couple of jobs at the time, mostly in the retail industry and the hospitality industry, and was also pretty miserable, made a decision that I needed to get back to school at all costs. But by then I had decided that art was not something I was going to go to school for. So I just took up at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and didn't even declare a major when I first got there because I was just kind of getting back into things. So part of my background is I have a tribal descendancy. And I got involved with the Native student group at UWM. I really started taking an interest in American Indian Studies classes and ended up declaring a double major in anthropology and American Indian Studies.
Did that make you feel more in touch with yourself, with who the real Amy was?
It definitely made me feel more in touch with what it is that I was going to ultimately be advocating for. I guess, like, I never thought about becoming a lawyer, ever. It was not anywhere on my radar screen.
Was there a pivotal moment that switch flipped on for you?
Yes and no. When I started working in, there was a moment when I was working as an archaeological field instructor,
mm-hmm.
Like as an assistant to a professor in an archaeological field school. And we were excavating what were supposed to be effigy mounts and came across human remains. And in that moment, I was done. I couldn't be working in that space anymore.
Sure.
Meaning in that moment for the field school. I came back from that experience and actually had an internship working for the Milwaukee Public Museum in the Department of Anthropology. And the specific project work that I was doing was for Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act work. I was working on the NAGPRA portfolio for the Ho-Chunk tribe of in Wisconsin.
And at that point, were you Amy Sings in the Timber, or did you have a traditional non-Indian name at that point?
At that point, I was still Amy Quigley. I had not yet married. So I was working on this particular project in this space, and the whole point of putting together this portfolio was to help the tribe and the museum come to some understandings about what objects they had in the museum's holdings and whether or not they rightfully should go back to the tribe. There was, this is my sort of flip the switch or
right.
you know, light bulb moment, was I was sitting in a meeting where on one side of the table there were representatives from the museum, on the other side of the museum's anthropology department, on the other side of the table there were representatives from the tribe, but there were lawyers that had nothing to do truly with either of these entities. They were like hired lawyers, right, separate, and they were doing all of the talking.
Wow.
And I remember in that moment thinking, if I want to make any big changes, maybe I should go to law school.
Right.
Maybe I should become a lawyer. And so it wasn't even right then and there that I did it. I was, in a different headspace about school. At that time, I was thinking I was going to be pursuing a master's and an interdisciplinary in anthropology, Native American studies, and museum studies. So had a completely different lens. NAGPRA was a new thing on the scene, and it was exciting time.
This meandering course that life.
But isn't it amazing how valuable museums are, right, to just inform the future by really looking at the past? And you came across something that was life-changing.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Museums can be incredibly controversial as
well. I know. Oh, yeah. I know. But I think what are we afraid of? What are we as a society afraid of by traveling back? But we have to travel back because the history is the roadmap of what we're looking at, what's going forward. I mean, happened.
And when you challenge it, for example, now giving medals to the U.S. soldiers at Wounded Knee.
Right.
Is, shocking. I mean, you've challenged history.
Right.
And there's a strong reaction to that.
Because people don't want to believe the history.
Well,
or they don't want to acknowledge the history.
For their own purposes, they may not want to believe it. But,
But isn't it, it's such a,
yes.
I mean, this is the conversation.
Where
the conversation we're having is the conversation we all need to have. I mean, people need to stop kind of butting heads and start looking at what we have in front of us and say, look here look at the history. Look at what went on.
Right.
Right. And you, when you saw the two lawyers, that in some ways, it sounds like it gave you the energy to say, I need to be the one flipping the switches.
Yeah.
Controlling things.
I'm waiting for them to say fake history.
Well
that's already been said.
I know it has.
But was seeing the lawyers in action the thing that's like, hey, if I'm going to make a change, I'm going to be the one.
It got me thinking about it. I said, I was already on this kind of path, this course. And so I said, well, maybe I should figure out if I really want to be a lawyer. Maybe it doesn't.
It's a tough road.
Right. But you made the decision to do it.
Well, I volunteered as a paralegal at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Legal Clinic. And
that was key.
That was a smart move.
That was a big move.
You could see what it's like.
Yeah, right.
It was a big move. It's
you're not doing corporate
really
law.
Really made me realize I don't want to be a paralegal.
Very valuable, though.
But when I was at that clinic, I got to work alongside of the legal. I mean, really, they're legal aid lawyers.
Right.
Is what
right.
those that particular. Group of attorneys are, and they were dealing a lot of, as you can imagine, students are dealing with a lot of landlord tenant, family law, and these kinds of things, right? Some labor law, and My favorite thing about serving in that clinic was doing the client intake. And so that, you know, I was like, well,
right. The people.
I don't really want to do like this like paperwork. but I really enjoyed
it. It was interesting getting to know all
these. Spending time with the clients.
Right.
And hearing their stories. And so I did make the decision to take the LSAT and see how I did and think about where would I want to go to law school. At the time, I wanted to practice in the area of Native American
Are you the only
graves
lawyer
production and repatriation.
Right.
And so I looked at only law schools that had strong federal
programs.
Law programs.
Are you the only lawyer in your family?
I was the first lawyer.
You were the first.
Uh-huh. Ah. So what was it about the University of Montana Law School that appealed to you related to that?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I was living in Milwaukee at the right. time, and I because I was there, I'm like, I'm going to, of course, apply to the University of Wisconsin School of Law, and I'm going to apply to Marquette.
Right.
Just in case. I might not get into any of these schools. Yeah. But I went and I talked with a professor at Marquette, and we were talking about my interest area, why do I want to practice law? And he said to me, oh, well, we don't really have much here in the way of Indian law. He said, but have you ever looked into the University of Montana? And I didn't even know.
They had a law school.
I knew nothing right, about right.
Missoula.
Yeah, right,
Missoula. Montana.
I couldn't pronounce Missoula when I got here.
Right on. Well, I.
What do you mean when you got here?
Before I got here, I was like, where are they? But anyway.
I found out I was pronouncing
wrong.
Helena wrong all the time.
Helena. Helena. Yeah.
So I applied and then the more that I started looking into this program, there was, you know, it's a clinical school. So you're required to take a clinic. Where at other schools, I'd be competing for a clinical opportunity. And there was the opportunity to learn from Professor Raymond Cross, who had been to the Supreme Court, and what an amazing opportunity.
Right, sure.
And there was the Indian Law Clinic, the Marjorie Hunter Brown Indian
right,
Law Clinic.
Right here.
So not only did I have a clinical opportunity, but right in the area that I was
Great law school.
Thinking.
So you get your law degree.
Yes.
We're going to get back to the Innocence Project. I know we're going to eventually get back.
We'll get there.
But
we'll
you
we'll
don't
meander.
Necessarily start doing Indian work, right?
I did end up serving my clinic. In
right,
the Indian Law
right,
Clinic.
And then you graduate.
And I had interned for the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin, and in their legal departments. And so then I had some exposure again to labor law and to Indian Gaming Regulatory Act and to a lot of education law as well in those experiences. Coming out right out of law school, though, I ended up working for the state of Montana in the Office of Public Instruction Indian Education Division.
Right.
And I
related, but not on your.
That's right.
Right, not in the bullseye
right.
of the target.
Well, and I got to tell you, there wasn't much going on in NAGPRA right. in the state of Montana at that time. Not that people weren't really eager to be putting things into play, but it was such a slow start, low funding, and not a lot of opportunity at that time.
Well, you know the story of Joe McDonald at Salish Kootenai. I mean, he was a high school teacher and started a college
yeah.
with no money or no yeah. staff. Right?
Wow, yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of the environment that you were operating in.
Sure.
Sort of resource deficient environment.
What years are we talking about? When did you graduate law school?
Graduated from law school in 2005.
2005. Mm-hmm. Got it. Wow.
Yeah.
And then somehow you ended up at Covenant House in Chicago.
Yeah.
Well, how'd that happen?
Again, with the nonlinear.
I think that's yeah. important to mention because as you talk about nonlinear, I don't think
right.
either of us, looking back, if –
Right.
When I was 20 years old, 25 years old, if I asked everybody I knew, where would I be You know, at the end of no one would have said Montana. Not a single person would have said that.
Not two Jewish guys from back east. Montana?
Yeah. We come from a different tribe, but that's a whole other story. Let's get back to you. So Covenant House, Chicago, nonlinear, what happened?
Yeah. I was approached by the brand new executive director of Covenant House, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Covenant House... well established,
well known, been around for you know, from the '60s.
Yeah.
As a runaway shelter.
Oh yeah,
other parts of
the world. They had other Covenant House in many places,
But had not established a home for youth in the city of Chicago. I was hired on originally with Covenant House to serve as their development director.
In Chicago.
At the time, they were they only had a drop-in center up mm-hmm. and off the grounds, and were looking to build
residential facility.
A residential facility. That's right.
Hmm.
And so it was at a time where there was a lot of dynamics going on, and I served in various roles.
Like in any startup, not NGO in a place like Chicago.
That's right. That's right.
The city that works, as you know, and you may not even know this.
What's that?
I ran one of the first runaway programs in the city of Chicago in the 80s. In the late 70s, early 80s.
And this is after the youth home that
I ran a countywide youth agency in the Cincinnati area for 5 years.
Right, okay.
Went to Washington, D.C. to work on youth advocacy work for the National Youth Work Alliance, and then became the executive director of the Youth Network Council of Chicago, and then started the Illinois Collaboration on Youth, which was around when you were there. I was the creator of that, and we got a large grant to operate a runaway shelter, and because of all the politics and because of all of the regulations we put together, instead of having a single facility, we had a network of foster homes for short-term care.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Back to Amy. Amy, so you're in Chicago, and then how long are you there for?
4 years.
4 years.
Almost exactly.
Got it. And then you move back here?
You come back to Montana without a job?
Yeah, I was. I had started a consulting business at the time, and I had some clients from the Chicago area and some clients from the Bay Area, and I was hoping to build a portfolio of clients in Montana. But there's a lot of different pressures and dynamics, and one of the things that just happened to happen while I was working my tail off trying to do that and raise my kiddos was... I got a call from the then president of the Montana Innocence Project Board and was asked if I might consider applying for a vacancy for their executive director role. And I gave that a lot of thoughts and had some preliminary conversations and ultimately ended up applying for the position. The hiring committee and the board at that time were asking a lot of really good questions about the work of an organization that had been around for a minute, not mm-hmm. a long, long time, right? I was established in 2008, and this was 2019.
Right.
But, you know, we really started asking a lot of questions about why is it that we have so many Native American applicants, and we don't have any Native American exonerees? Why is it that we struggle so hard to move investigations for Indigenous applicants past the investigative stage and into a secondary stage of investigation and active litigation?
And how did that make you feel as an applicant to be executive director? Did it resonate? That's what I was going to say. Yeah. It sounds like that kind of hit your sweet spot.
Absolutely. So, you know, really taking a look at a background of advocacy in a number of respects, but always from a legal aid and a defense lens, I was deeply interested in the fact that they were asking really good questions. And it was timely for that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, your background, obviously in advocacy, but also development, fit perfectly.
Right? Yes.
How much of your role today is on the advocacy, working with the other attorneys and the board, et cetera, versus fundraising? Like, we always ask this to our guests that are in this space because it's an inordinate amount of time spent in development.
You know, I think the way that I look at it is there is an exceptional amount of time spent in relationships.
Mm.
You know, I really think that the reason that I became an accidental development person, I think a lot of executive directors are, right? Accidental.
Yeah, you don't go get an MBA in finance and become an executive director of a not-for-profit.
But I think it's the relational aspect of it. I mean, it's the very same reason I enjoyed doing client intake. It's people. I love to hear people's stories and why they care about things and what motivates them to not only get up in the morning, but to move to action. And so I do spend a fair amount of time raising dollars to serve the mission and the work of the project. But I think people think that when you say, oh, 50% of my time is development, they're thinking you're like out asking constantly. Right. And it's never that way.
You mentioned an interesting word which has multiple meanings. You said mission. In some organizations, you have a mission statement and it's sort of cut and dried and bland and it's not emotionally charged. But you're on a mission, which is a different kind of thing. And and you have a cadre of people out there whose lives are dependent on the work that you can do on their behalf.
Totally.
Yeah.
You know, and as you said, you have a meandering path, you know, starting off with art. But those things didn't fit, you know. And lucky we live long enough in this era now that you can find something, you know, in your prime of your life that has that kind of meaning and, you know, can have such, you know, reward. I mean, not every case is going to work out perfectly and not every situation you're going to be able to be successful. But those nuggets that are fuel to, I would assume, you know, keep driving you to do this. It's hard to do it. I did it for half my career and then I couldn't do it anymore. It was just too much. I understand in the work that you do, I mean, there's a lot of fundraising. What else are the challenges that you're facing in running the Innocence Project?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ernie. I think that the challenges that we're up against, it's becoming a theme, but they're also relational challenges. We're in this, you know, we're working to change the system, but while we're working to change the system,
we have to be
working within it. That's right. And because our mission is to make certain that individuals who should not be sitting in prison are able to achieve their freedom and not only achieve their freedom, but to really come back to community in a way that is safe for everybody, and where they can be contributors. They can contribute in the civic space. They can contribute in an economic space. They can contribute in their family space and in their communities in a number of ways. We're tasked with building relationships with the very institutions that you know hold folks and with agencies that on paper seem like they should align, like our missions and our work should align, right? But that doesn't always work out in practice. So we're doing the hard work of building those relationships right now.
Well, you mentioned an important word, mission, and most organizations have a mission statement, but it's kind of a bland thing. In this case, you have a mission, a personal mission, and it affects people's lives. and people are counting on you to help improve a horrible circumstance that they find themselves in. And that's become, to me, from listening to you, much more of a personal mission than just something that sits on the wall of an office that says, this is our mission statement.
That's right.
Arnie will be right back. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Amy Sings in the Timber.
So what's going on with the case that Scott alluded to?
Yes, absolutely. So that particular case is one of the first cases that we, it came to us in a way other than this young person applying to us by writing to us. We learned of it from a deep dive, really, into some records about the current population of Montana state prisons. And when we followed up with some individuals who also, like I was mentioning before, we work with a number of different organizations that do adjacent work to the work that we do, they said, we do know this individual, and we think absolutely there's something amiss here, and it would be great if you would go and visit with her. So we're right now at the phase of investigation where we have done a file review.
Right, and now it's confidential until we get to some resolution.
That's right. We're entering into that sort of more intensive phase of investigation where we actually would do some field work.
Well, when this gets adjudicated and resolved, we want you to come back and tell us about it.
I would love to.
But importantly, for the people that are listening and feel that they would like to help you with your mission, how do they contribute? How do they find out more about the Innocence Project? What's the route to you?
Sure, certainly. So there's, of course, always our websites. It's mtinnocenceproject.org. We're on all of the social media channels as well. So that's always a great place to be able to.
And they can contribute through that vehicle?
They can contribute absolutely through our website.
Do you have any fundraising event coming up or events coming up?
So we traditionally haven't done fundraising events. We are thinking about changing that. We've done some small intimate events like house parties and we always host an event for Wrongful Conviction Day, which actually was October 2nd. So not that long ago, and we have kind of an educational program as well as some other fundraising activities around those events. But we are considering having our first ever kind of more gala type of events in the early winter, January or February of 2027.
I was going to ask you just to close out. What's your vision for the Montana Innocence Project now that you've been there five years?
That's a great question. So we are actually we're putting the closing session on our strategic planning process that we have come through over the course of the last year. And there are so many big and exciting things that I feel are underway for the projects and for the population that we serve. I had said earlier that we're a law firm, essentially, and that is true. We we operate a legal program like a law firm. But there's the other half of that mission that's been there since the founding of this organization, and that is advocacy and policy. We don't just want to see one individual be freed. We want to see change. We want to see the kind of change that's lasting. We know that mass incarceration is undeniable, and you can't one off. One, we can't even do it from a staffing perspective. But two, if one wrongfully convicted individual, if one innocent individual can get locked up, then we really need to be taking a serious look at the system and the factors that lead to it and making some changes at the policy level. So that's a big part of what we're looking at. We'll be looking at a new, essentially for us, it's a six-year policy agenda because of the biennium that takes a look at some of the things that not only cause or contribute to wrongful convictions, but also like taking a look at a more robust reentry system.
Sure.
for maybe the for the first time ever.
Right. There's a lot of work to be done in advocacy.
That's
and,
right.
And in societal institutional change.
And we would really like to see some true, like, let's take a second chance lens at this.
Yeah.
Let's not look at this from a you know, so if somebody has done something wrong, we're going to lock them up and throw away the key.
Yeah.
Let's talk about moving from profit and punishment to healing and really like engagement. Mm-hmm. Let's take a very different approach to this overall.
And on that note, Scott,
you know what, Amy? Thank you. You were a great guest. We appreciate the time. Arnie, see you next Sunday.
Thank you, Amy. We'll take care.
Thank you both. It's great to be here.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.